Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Cities are playing a crucial role in combating climate change. According to C40 Cities, a network of the world's megacities committed to addressing climate change, 70% of cities are already dealing with the effects. Nearly all are at risk. By 2050, 4 out of 5 people around the world will live in cities and towns, so this is a very important issue. Over 90% of all urban areas are coastal, putting most cities on Earth at risk of flooding from rising sea levels and powerful storms. And we did a show about this recently, about sea levels. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about which cities and countries are leading the way in mitigating and adapting to climate change. Last year, Germany got international headlines for setting a new record. Nearly 75% of its power needs were generated from renewable energy. Uruguay recently announced that 95% of its electricity is generated from renewables. So where are other examples and what is happening in your city? Today we are joined by Tom D'Alessio. He's president, CEO, and publisher of Next City, a nonprofit whose mission is to inspire social, economic, and environmental change in cities. And Tom joins us from the Climate Conference in Paris. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Having me.
Thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Mary Kay Magstad. She's an award-winning China correspondent. Mary Kay has spent over 2 decades in Asia. She was the first Beijing bureau chief for NPR. She runs a biweekly podcast on PRI called Whose Century Is It? And Mary Kay Magstad joins us from San Francisco. Hi, Mary Kay. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to be back.
Great to have you. So, Tom, let's start off with you since you are at the Climate Conference in Paris. It's scheduled to wrap up tomorrow. Before we dive in and talk about cities and countries that are embracing renewables, give us a sense of what's happening right now. Is there any sign of what the final agreement will look like?
They released the latest draft yesterday afternoon amid a big scramble. And a lot of folks here have expressed considerable optimism. Apparently, in previous COPs, things happen literally at the last minute, but there is optimism because we have 196 countries participating that we will actually achieve an agreement. And in fact, the number of negotiated settlements has actually been reduced significantly just over the last couple of days as we go forward. It's been remarkable to see the progress that's been happening here. And as we move forward, we're very much interested in seeing a final result.
Well, it's great to hear that because in past conferences, people have been very disappointed and let down. So it's nice to hear the word progress. As someone who cares about these issues and focuses on them, what can you give us a sense of that kind of progress? Why are you so hopeful about this?
Well, in speaking with presenters and delegates, as well as citizens and interest groups here, everyone to a person has said that we need to have an agreement. So in and of itself, that's critically important. There is a recognition that climate change is real and the science is indisputable. And so what's happening now and what we're seeing is that it seems to be a negotiated settlement with France taking the lead, bringing all of the nations together. And what we're finding is that there are a couple of major camps. Obviously, the developed countries, the LDCs, the least developed countries, and then we have a number of other countries that are engaged in the conversation. But as of 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, the agreement, there were 366 brackets and 47 options remaining. Brackets mean that any country has the opportunity to object to even one word in the agreement. And so those are the brackets. It could be one word, it could be a sentence, it could be a paragraph. And then the options basically are opportunities that they're putting forward. We've actually gotten down to 29 pages for an agreement, which is phenomenal. And as I said, 197 countries must agree on this. And so what we're hoping is that it won't be something so generic that it doesn't mean anything. We don't expect that it will be one specific agreement that will have specific targets and standards that everyone has to apply. What we anticipate is what's being called a bindingness by the head of this program, Cristina Figueres. So Christiana has basically said she thinks that because each country has, over 180 countries have submitted their own individual plans on what, how they're actually going to tackle climate change, that this agreement's going to accommodate all of those different plans and find ways for each country to actually address what is a critical need of trying to limit the carbon in the atmosphere as well as the temperature to less than 2 degrees increase.
And so we did a show on Tuesday about how cities are tackling climate change, and today we wanted to drill down and focus on renewable energy. So can you give us a sense of how will this treaty, how will that affect renewable energy? What really strikes you about the different plans coming from different countries and how they want to move forward when it comes to leaving fossil fuels in the ground and embracing renewable energy?
To a person, I've been hearing folks talk about a carbon-free world, which is amazing to me. It's a new language that's being spoken. And what makes this COP different than other COPs in the past is that the private sector is a major participant. And so you have major corporations and CEOs stepping forward saying we need to be a carbon-free world. We had Elon Musk come the other day and say we need a carbon tax.
CEO of Tesla. I just said he's the CEO of Tesla.
That's correct, right. Yes. And we have the CEOs of other major corporations. The chairman of Kellogg Corporation stepped forward and said they are changing the way they do business to be carbon-free in the future. And we're seeing car companies like Renault and others that are saying electric vehicles are the future. This is a fundamental change, and what it says is that corporations and private businesses aren't waiting for national and international agreements. We also had an event the other day led by C40. These are the major cities around the world that are committed to addressing climate change, and they've signed an agreement to say that each of these cities will be taking actions on their own to address climate change. What was most interesting to me was at the end of that session last week, former Mayor Michael Bloomberg stood up and said, we're going to have an agreement, I'm confident of that, but the targets that are in the agreement won't take effect until 2020. In the meantime, cities around the world are going to be setting their own bars, and they are going to raise the level of ambition for that next agreement.
That is Tom DeLacio. He is president of Next City. It's a nonprofit whose mission is to inspire social, economic, and environmental change in cities. And he's joining us from the climate conference in Paris. Today, we are talking about the countries and the cities that are embracing renewable energy. And what Tom was talking about, how so many people are focusing on leaving fossil fuels in the ground, that has been a major call from activists over the last year, 6 months. We've seen so much, really a lot of movement around that. So the activists really deserve so much credit because that's the call, leave the fossil fuels in the ground. Mary Kay Magstad is an award-winning China correspondent. And Mary, what strikes you about China's role in these talks? The New York Times just published a piece, China raises its target for renewable energy. China now wants to generate 150 to 200 gigawatts of electricity using solar power by 2020, which would possibly quadruple the previous target. That's a big shift. What strikes you about the role China's playing in embracing renewables?
Well, there has been so much that has changed in how China has approached the whole issue of climate change over the last decade. When I was based in China throughout the first decade of the 2000s, the rhetoric was still along the lines of, you know, hey, you Western countries had your 100, 150 years of dirty development, and you prospered. Now it's our turn. And then something shifted, and the government started to recognize, you know, we're creating a mess for ourselves. We are also going to be affected by climate change. We are, in fact, already being affected by climate change. We've got 1.5 million people every year dying prematurely of causes related to pollution, which isn't specifically climate change related, but they overlap. So they started to act to increase renewables and reduce reliance on fossil fuels and specifically on coal. at the moment, there's a plan to try to increase the total energy mix of the total amount of renewables in China's total energy mix to 15% from 11% at the end of last year. That's already quite a leap. Some of that will be nuclear energy and energy coming from dams, from hydropower. But China is already the world's biggest user of wind energy and solar energy. It is committed to trying to bring down the cost of solar energy and wind energy. The government has been leaning on the state-run grid to take up more solar and wind energy on the grid. At the moment, something like 10% of solar energy and 15% of wind energy gets wasted. It's generated, but it's wasted because the grid's not using it efficiently. So the government has called for more demand-side management for the grid to look at when are people using energy that will be available, renewable energy that will be available, and take it up more efficiently at those times. So the government has had this major sea change in how it approaches climate change, energy, renewable energy. It also sees a big opportunity for China in terms of being a leader in the renewable energy market. And that's been something it's been working on for a decade.
What explains this drastic change?
Multiple things. On the, you know, being a leader in the renewable energy market, certainly it's a business opportunity. On the climate change front, China's environmentalists and research think tanks and government officials are looking at some of the ways in which climate change is already affecting China. Rising sea levels could affect coastal Chinese cities. It's already affecting precipitation. There are droughts and floods coming in waves that China hasn't seen in quite a long time, and that affects, you know, how much China can be self-sufficient in food. Glaciers are melting more quickly within China than had been expected, and as they are everywhere in the world. But I think, you know, finally there's been an aha moment where it's like, oh, this could affect our water supply. Without water, we're totally screwed. So, you know, let's try to slow this down. And also recognizing that losing 1.5 million people a year from illnesses due to, you know, caused by air pollution is just too high a cost to pay for development. And China's people have been pushing back really hard. That's what they say. Like, yeah, we don't want to live in this kind of world. We don't want our children growing up in this kind of a world. Do something about it.
So 1.5 million people are dying every year in China? And the cause could be
prematurely due to causes related to air pollution.
Wow. Well, on Tuesday, Beijing issued a red alert on pollution levels. Schools were shut down. The city, Beijing's more than 20 million residents were told to wear face masks, and cars with odd-numbered license plates were ordered off the road. This is the worst pollution the city has ever seen. So is this out of the ordinary that the government would issue a red alert on pollution levels?
Okay, so it's not the worst pollution the city has ever seen. When I was living there in January 2013, the pollution levels were twice as bad as they were this week. But China did not issue a red alert because they were basically in denial. They basically did not want to admit that the pollution levels were as bad as they were. It's actually, ironically, good news that they're issuing a red alert, letting the population know, we recognize that this is bad. We're trying to do something about it. We're trying to protect you and your kids from being out in the middle of this. Something else that's, you know, sort of paradoxically good news at the moment is that China's coal use last year actually dropped in absolute terms. It may come back up again, but overall, the percentage of coal being used in China's total energy mix is declining. And China has, you know, 18 months ago, pledged to cap total CO2 emissions by 2030. So all of this will contribute, along with more efficient use of energy, more efficient coal power plants when coal is being used, to there being less air pollution over time. It's just that this does take time to change. There are a lot of old power plants in China. Many of them are being shut down now. Those that are remaining are being required to use coal scrubbers to have cleaner emissions, slightly cleaner emissions. But, you know, it's not going to change in 2 or 3 years. What is good news in the midst of all of this smog is that the government is now mostly moving in the right direction. There is resistance from interest groups within the Chinese state-run enterprises. Back 2-3 years ago, it came out that gasoline for cars had actually been refined at a lower level than it was supposed to be refined to, so just the emissions from that gap was causing a lot of the smog in cities. Why was the refinement not to a higher level? Because the state-run enterprises were profiting from not having to refine gas to that higher level. So the government leaned on them and said, yeah, actually, now it's time to do what you were supposed to have been doing from the beginning.
Tom, what do you make of these major changes that are coming out of China, and what are people in Paris saying about these changes, the fact that China is the biggest user now of wind and solar?
That has come as a surprise to a number of people here. On the central message that many people in America came to Paris understanding was that China might potentially be one of the laggard countries in these negotiations. And in fact, one of the significant concerns is that China might be pressured by some of the least developing countries or less developed countries or the developing countries, that China might actually be pressured to withhold support on this. And so it's very promising to hear that China's actually stepped forward with a number of initiatives. That's a break from that idea that growing countries can't be resilient and can't be sustainable.
Tom DeLacio is president of Next City, a nonprofit whose mission is to inspire social, economic, and environmental change in cities. Tom is joining us from the climate conference in Paris. Mary Kay Magstad is an award-winning China correspondent. She spent over 2 decades in Asia. She was the first Beijing bureau chief for NPR. She also now runs a biweekly podcast on PRI called Whose Century Is It? And we are talking today about which cities and countries are embracing renewable energy. Tuesday, we talked about how cities are dealing with climate change. Today, we're drilling down a bit and talking about renewable energy. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about what's happening in Paris? And especially when we're talking about renewable energy, what is happening in your city? What is your city doing well? And what can it do better? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now I would like to welcome Paul Brown to the show. Paul is a joint editor at the Climate News Network, a nonprofit that focuses on these issues. He's a columnist for The Guardian. He was an environmental correspondent for The Guardian for more than 2 decades, and he's written 8 books on environmental issues. And Paul also joins us from the conference in Paris. Hi, Paul. Thank you for joining us.
Hello. Yes.
Well, it's great to have you. You have covered these issues for a long time. And so since we're on the topic of China, what really strikes you about the changes that you have seen over the years and how now China is really coming to the table, really embracing renewable energy?
Well, the extraordinary thing about China really is how fast things have moved in a very short space of time. I went to China myself to do some journalistic training a few years ago, and the transformation then was obvious. They suddenly encouraged all their journalists to write about climate change when before it had been a forbidden subject. They suddenly realized that their renewable energy industry was the future. And I was amazed how quickly they turned the industry around. And as you've just been discussing, it's now a huge industry in China, and our perceptions of China need to be updated, I think.
And can you give us a sense of how other countries in Paris are responding to the changes coming out of China?
Well, the other thing is that at these talks, the Chinese would never talk to anybody. And now they're so willing to talk to people like me that it really surprises one. I mean, their whole attitude has been transformed because they want to tell everybody what that China is moving forward. They're also extremely loyal to all the developing countries. They will not break away from supporting the smallest and least developed countries, and they do act as a figurehead, really, for those countries.
Can you give us some more information, elaborate on that? Can you give us an example?
The least developed countries are in danger of being left behind in the talks because they've got the fewest number of delegates here. They don't have a lot of money to bring many people. They're very underrepresented journalistically. But every time anybody tries to pull the wool over their eyes, China steps in and say, no, you can't go there.
Huh.
So I think they're very, very strong in helping underdeveloped countries.
What do you think explains that?
Sorry? What do you think? Well, I think China is, if you talk in political terms, they're very keen to get a foothold in many parts of the world, like Africa, and they, some of the least developed countries, of course, and the poorest countries are in Africa. So they want to increase their sphere of influence in the world. So it's not all altruism by any stretch of the imagination, but they are trying very hard to keep the family, if you like, of what they call the G77 here, which is more than 100 countries, together in one umbrella organization in order to be a counterbalance to the rich countries like yourselves and ours.
And Mary Kay, you have spent 2 decades in Asia. You were the first Beijing bureau chief for NPR. What are your thoughts about what Paul is saying, just in terms of China, giving a voice to the smaller countries, encouraging journalists in China for the first time to write about climate change? Are you also seeing that? Mary Kay?
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
So I would add one more thing, and that's that China has said over time that poor countries, developing countries, need to be compensated for what they're struggling with related to climate change as a result of dirty development by developed countries over the course of the century. And there is a call for a fund of, I believe it's $100 billion a year to help mitigate the effects of climate change. There has been discussion at the Paris talks about whether China, as the world's second largest economy, should be contributing to that fund. And China says, no, we shouldn't, because we're still a developing country. It's interesting seeing them take this stance, as they did in previous climate talks, at a time when, in every other way, China is presenting itself to the world as the rising superpower, almost, inevitably placed to, surpass the United States at some point. I would, say that that's not inevitable, but certainly China will be a major power in the world, already is a major power in the world. They have several other funds through which they're helping developing countries. They have a $3 billion South-South Climate Cooperation Fund. They have a $40 billion fund for countries along the Ancient Silk Road. They have their new $100 billion 57-nation Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. These are all ways in which China is directly helping developing countries, in some ways connected to climate change. They just don't want to be locked in as a developed country having to contribute to this fund, because that would also have an effect on how quickly China has to bring down its emissions. Hmm. So they're kind of trying to have it both ways. They're in an interesting position where they still have many poor people, but they're, a very, very powerful economy.
Right. Well, Mary Kay, thank you so much for joining us. And we'll follow this. I think it'd be interesting to do an entire show on China.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Mary Kay Magstadt, she's an award-winning China correspondent. She spent over 2 decades in Asia and was the first Beijing bureau chief for NPR. She runs the biweekly podcast on PRI called Whose Century Is It? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, from the BBC. It's World Have Your Say. Bina from our friends at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center at noon. And then this afternoon at 1, it's open air with David Latu Leap. This week, a holiday preview of some of the many festive cultural happenings in the Bay Area. Joining David on today's open air, comedian Will Durst. That's coming up at 1 o'clock, open air, here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it is our media roundtable. We'll be discussing coverage of Islamophobic and xenophobic rhetoric coming from Republican presidential candidates and right-wing news organizations. How are the media framing the underlying reasons for the current political climate in the United States? That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the climate talks in Paris by focusing on the cities and the countries that are embracing renewable energy. And joining us from Paris, our two guests, Tom DeLacio is president of Next City, a nonprofit whose mission is to inspire social, economic, and environmental change in cities. And Paul Brown is joint editor at the Climate News Network. He was an environment correspondent for The Guardian for more than two decades. He's now a columnist for The Guardian. He's also written eight books on environmental issues. And Paul, when we began the show, Tom was saying that he is very hopeful about the deal that is coming out of Paris, and the conference is going to wrap up tomorrow. What are your thoughts about the final agreement and what it might look like?
Well, first of all, I admire his optimism. Yes, of course, there will be an agreement in Paris. The question is whether the agreement will be strong enough to avert dangerous climate change. And that is what we're all hoping it will be. But, of course, these deals require progress year on year and what they call here a ratcheting up effect, so that targets get better next year and the year after. So far, we don't know enough detail. The other thing I'd say is if it finishes tomorrow, which it's due to do, it'll be a great surprise, because none of these climate talks have ever finished on time. I should think lunchtime on Saturday would be more optimistic.
And then can you also talk about calls from activists to leave fossil fuels in the ground and to embrace renewable energy? What are your thoughts about how that will end up in the agreement, where we actually see something tangible?
Well, yes, I do think we'll see something tangible on that. And then the reason is that renewable energies are now come down so far in price that they compete with fossil fuels. And if that is happening across the world, and the market for fossil fuels is actually disappearing, it's no coincidence that we have a very low coal price and a low oil price, because there is a surplus of both those products. And of course, the result of that is that people won't invest any longer in coal and oil. The price of stocks in Peabody Coal and things like that is so low now compared to what it was only 4 years ago. People are disinvesting. And the reason is simply because there is no future in fossil fuels. Now, obviously, we're still very heavily dependent on them in many aspects of our lives. But technology is moving so fast that I'm more optimistic, in fact, about the technology than I am about the politics. And we have such a huge drive in so many areas like battery technology that I'm sure that the breakthroughs will soon make fossil fuels redundant, and never mind the politics.
In September, Paul, you wrote a piece, Political Will is the Only Barrier to 100% Renewables. Can you talk about the changes that you've seen from city leaders when it comes to embracing renewables?
Yes, I think there's a much greater political will among people in cities for all sorts of reasons, like air pollution and so on, which improve public health, but also because the smaller the unit, the easier it is to carry the community with you. I think it's much harder to get the whole country to have renewables than it is a small town or a small city. And gradually, you build up leadership from below, if you like. Communities are very good. And some cities have done remarkable things while their governments have done very little. So I'm much impressed by the way that cities across the world are getting together and showing each other what they can do in quite difficult circumstances. It's very, very impressive.
Can you talk about cities that might not be getting attention? Because we often hear about Germany. They set a record last year, 75% of their power needs were generated from renewable energy. What cities, or even a country maybe, what are we not hearing about in the media?
Well, we're not hearing much about the UK at the moment. We're going backwards in the UK. Air pollution in London is worse than it was 5 years ago, and we're about to be prosecuted by the European Union because we're not doing enough for air pollution. So some cities are going backwards while others are going forwards. And I think, again, it's all down to political will. You know, London is no different than Berlin. In fact, they're very similar in many respects. And yet Berlin is going forwards and we're going backwards. So it all boils down to who you've got at the top, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Why is the UK going backwards?
A good question. It's very hard to know. We've just removed subsidies from wind power and solar power and increased it for fracking gas, which many people think is going completely the wrong direction. It's a Conservative government policy. What can you say?
That is Paul Brown. He's joint editor at the Climate News Network and a columnist for The Guardian. He's written 8 books on environmental issues. Tom D'Alessio is president of Next City, a nonprofit whose mission is to inspire environmental change in cities. And Tom and Paul are both joining us from Paris. So if you have any questions about what's going on in Paris, specifically when we're talking about cities and countries that are embracing renewable energies, We'd love to hear from you. Also, what are you seeing in your area? What is positive? What can your city do better? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're going to talk with you, Tom, about Germany, because you've written about German cities that are really leading the way. But are there any other cities that might not be getting much attention that we don't hear about regularly?
Yes, indeed. And one of the great benefits of the COP session is it's enabling us to hear from these mayors and from these regional and national leaders throughout the world. So by way of example, the C40 meeting, we heard from mayors from Vancouver, Stockholm, Auckland, Sydney, Washington, D.C., New York, all award recipients for doing some amazing things to move towards a carbon-free world. And literally as we speak, the United Nations is holding a winner's announcement of 16 game-changing initiatives that are lighthouse activities that are actually providing momentum for change. Everything from in Rwanda and Tanzania, powering homes with solar energy, to in Africa, an innovative pay-as-you-go energy system for rural homes. Mm. In Colombia, they're reducing emissions in manufacturing. In Benin, empowering women farmers through solar drip irrigation. They're supporting sustainable growth in emerging cities in the Caribbean and Latin America. And in India, they're creating jobs to keep e-waste out of landfills. So it's just amazing to see these and other initiatives that are happening. And you just can't help but feel the excitement that once the message gets out and the average citizen starts to understand that business, that citizens, that government, that nonprofit organizations are all coming together, that there is going to be a change. And I, as I said, I'm confident by 2050, it'll be a significantly different world, and we are moving well towards a carbon-free world.
Wow. That is Tom D'Alessio. He's president of Next City. And Paul Brown is joint editor at the Climate News Network. They're both joining us from Paris. We're talking about cities and countries that are embracing renewables. And let's hear from Marina in San Francisco. Hi, Marina. Welcome to the show.
Hi. We live in San Francisco and are considering solar panels on our roof, and we were told that PG&E is probably in the next month going to be changing their system where they give you credit for, you know, the credit payback, banking your energy. I don't know exactly what it's called, but and then I heard on the radio yesterday that Arizona is now charging, you know, their electrical company is charging solar clients $50 a month, you know, a flat rate, because the electrical companies are losing profits. And so I think there's a disconnect between what politicians, what consumers, you know, we would love to reduce our energy and go, you know, use renewables, but I think these corporations are going to fight tooth and nail. And I mean, we're already seeing that, and you know, we're probably not going to spend $30,000 or whatever it is on solar panels if we're not going to get any savings. And PG&E will, you know, assess us that, you know, the sky's the limit.
Right.
That's $50 today and $100 tomorrow, and consumers are powerless unless it can be completely off the grid, and that's probably not going to happen anytime soon. So.
Well, thank you for calling, Marina. Tom, were you able to hear Marina?
I was, and what we're hearing here, to get sort of a global perspective, is two central ideas that are to her question. Number one's the question of how do you actually address the financial aspects of this through regulation and investment. And one of the ideas that's being solidly considered around here is we need to stop subsidizing the fossil fuel industry, and we need to level the playing field, and we need to internalize all of the costs that now go on. So all of the health costs that are directly related to fossil fuel industries need to somehow be addressed. Mm-hmm. And if we can stop, as I said, subsidizing the fossil fuel industry through our tax policy, and then number two, understand what the other costs are to using fossil fuels, health costs, social costs, et cetera, and then figure out ways to actually say, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to find a way to avoid those costs. It starts to make renewables so much more affordable as we go through. The third aspect is the investment side, and what's being talked around here is creating capacity around the world, in countries and in cities, to actually enable solar and other renewables to happen, and that countries would actually provide funding. So there's this green fund that's being created, and there's a desire to enable $100 billion a year by 2020 to actually provide this capacity to cities and nations to provide for renewables. Whether we get to the $100 billion is, in my mind, questionable, but the larger point is we're moving in that direction, and corporations and individuals and countries are now understanding the need for that.
And what would you say to Marina and others like her who want to embrace solar, for example, but now they're not getting as many credits maybe, or the cost is going up because the energy companies know that they won't be getting their monthly payment?
There is always a financial aspect to all of this. I will say to her and others, I have solar panels on my roof. I did it not because of the tax benefits. I did it because I believed it would be sustainable. There have been financial incentives to that. They will change, yes. And as the level, the playing field becomes more level, a number of those financial incentives will start to go away. You want to create a market-based solution. And I'm convinced that if we do level the playing field, we are approaching a situation where renewables are becoming competitive with the fossil fuel industry.
And Paul, do you have anything to add on this?
Well, I would say that I too have solar panels on my roof, and as a result of that, I'm much more aware of the electricity I use, and the price of solar panels in the UK has halved and then halved again in the last 10 years, and they are now very much competitive with the cost of fuel you buy from the grid. So actually already in Europe, I would say that the costs of solar and ordinary electricity from coal-fired and nuclear stations is roughly the same.
And Paul, how are governments in European cities supporting the renewable energy sector?
Well, it varies from country to country, but most countries do guarantee a price for 20 years from solar if you install them on your domestic property, and also for factories and get a smaller subsidy. But that subsidy has fallen and fallen again. And in the UK, it is just about to be abolished completely. In fact, we're expecting an announcement in a few days of how that is going to tail down to no subsidy at all. And that is because the government believes that the price of solar is now equal to the price of fossil fuels. And that's without taking into account the extra carbon tax that fossil fuels should be paying but aren't so far, because the government continues to allow them to pollute the atmosphere without any penalty.
And are European governments making solar more affordable for citizens?
Are they making it more affordable?
Are there subsidies, for example?
In the past, I mean, my solar panels, when I installed them 5 years ago, I got a guaranteed price for 20 years, which is much higher than the guaranteed price you get now if you installed solar panels. And they intend to take the subsidy away completely. And that is because solar power now costs the same as everything else, so they don't feel they need to subsidize it anymore. It's an argument that the solar panel industry says is going to damage the industry because they still need a subsidy for a little while. But how long that is going to be needed, of course, is a political decision.
Well, thank you for calling, Marina. And we have a related call from Sarah in San Francisco. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know that... the PG&E is trying to institute an extra charge because solar isn't going to profit them as much as they had planned for. The California Public Utilities Commission, which kind of oversees this sort of thing, is going to have a meeting about it next Thursday, December 17th, 9:30 a.m., 505 Van Ness. So if you want to show up and speak or, just sort of blare or... send them an email. Do that. The information about where to send an email, I think the 350bayarea.org site will have it. CPUC site.gov might have it. I hope some of this is helpful. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And we will find a link to that and put it at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for that call. If you'd like to give us a call to talk about renewable energy, what is happening in your area, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Today, we're joined by two guests from the climate conference in Paris. Tom D'Alessio is president of Next City, a nonprofit whose mission is to inspire social and environmental change in cities. Paul Brown is a joint editor at the Climate News Network. Definitely check out their journalism. He's also a columnist for The Guardian. He's written 8 books on environmental issues. I wanted to also talk to you both about what's happening in Uruguay. They're now getting some international headlines just announcing that clean energy sources provide almost 95% of the nation's electricity. Tom, are people talking about this at the climate conference?
That's especially a topic of interest because next year the UN is holding its once every 20-year program in Quito, Ecuador, nearby, and that'll be Habitat 3. And so the countries of South America have really stepped up to the plate on a number of the challenges. I don't know the Uruguay situation in great detail. I do know in Colombia, in particular in Medellin, They've been doing some amazing work to create sustainable and resilient communities. And they've been using renewable energy and other systems, transportation systems and others, to transform their city.
The Guardian has a piece on this, and it says that the Uruguay's low-carbon mix of wind, solar, biomass, and hydropower make up 55% of the country's energy mix. Also, Uruguay has managed to pivot away from oil, which accounted for 27% of Uruguay's imports, in just 15 years, which provides a case study for the nations currently figuring out a solution to reduce their carbon footprint and embrace renewable energy. Paul, what really strikes you about what you're seeing in South America?
Well, it's a classic example of what you can do if you stop talking and get on with it. it really is an astonishing record, and it is, as we discussed earlier, a question of political will. I mean, the government decided this is what they were going to do, and of course it cuts down on import bills. It makes people feel more self-reliant, and the whole country is a lot cleaner and more forward-looking than it was before. And it's an example. I mean, it's not a rich country. Yeah, it's a country where the people decided, along with the government, that they were going to do this, and they've done it. And if they can do it, I'm sure the rest of the world can do it.
I really like how you put that, Paul. Just get on with it. Just do the right thing.
Well, you're famous in America for being able to get on with things, and it's a deep problem that you're not getting on with it. I'm sure you can move mountains if you want to, and we're all looking to America to show us a lead, in fact.
Right. Well, what do you think about what's coming out of the United States and what it's doing and what it's not doing?
Well, I think you are making huge amounts of progress, but you've been wedded to fossil fuels in a sense like no other country, because you drive so much and you use so much energy. And so it is very, very difficult to wean yourself off it. And also, you have an extremely strong fossil fuel lobby. There's no doubt that the contrarians of the world who refuse to accept that climate change is happening at all have the strongest support in the United States. So you've got a mountain to climb. But I do think that the issue is turning around in America, that my visits to America over the years, I've always felt that public opinion in America was 10 years behind Europe on this issue, if no other. So, but I do think things are turning around, and I think once you get stuck in as a nation to changing things, you'll move very fast indeed.
And Tom, what would you add to that? We did a show yesterday about the revelations from Inside Climate News about Exxon's own scientist back in the 70s saying that we're going to have a major catastrophe because of fossil fuel production, and how they were able to successfully suppress that information over the past couple of decades and fund a lot of these climate-denying think tanks. So what are your thoughts about the changes you're seeing in the U.S.? What are you hopeful about, and what needs to change?
Well, as I said before, I think the most spectacular thing I've seen is major industries and corporations stepping up to the plate here in Paris at COP21, saying we want a carbon-free, a carbon-neutral world. So when you have corporations speaking, I hope our congressional leaders are listening. It's very unfortunate that it has become a partisan issue. It did not used to be one. But what I've seen here, unfortunately, in Paris, is a partisan issue. We had 10 U.S. senators come, United States senators come and speak to the issue. Not one of them was a Republican. That's unfortunate. Mm. We've had a number of governors come and speak, Governor Brown in particular being a forceful speaker on this issue. But the governor of Washington State and a couple of other leaders from various states and cities, unfortunately, not one Republican standing up saying this is what we need to do. But that's not the case in the business world and corporations. I imagine a number of the corporate executives who spoke over the last week at the various initiatives that were around Paris may vote Republican, may even be Republican. And I think it's unfortunate that the National Party is not listening to these people. I know that the presidential candidates are not listening to these people, and I think that's going to change. One curious thing to note, I heard last week a conversation about what the effect of this could potentially be in future elections. There's a belief that unless the Republican Party starts understanding this issue and starts moving on the issue of climate change, they could potentially lose the under 35 vote. And if you lose that, you lose the election for the future.
Right. Well, at the moment, the presidential candidates do not say they don't believe in climate change, or they're climate change deniers, whatever you want to call them. But in terms of cities, Paul, final thoughts. Despite national policies, how can city policies change what's happening at the national level?
Well, I think people lead by example. And, I mean, if you look at the figures of how the world is changing, CO2 emissions are reducing in some parts of the world, and in cities, some cities are a lot healthier than other cities, and it's all down to how much fossil fuel they produce, how many cars they have on their roads, and people can see by example that they would prefer to live, say, in a green city than in a dirty one. And I think national politicians will sooner or later realize that there's votes in health and good quality environment and the future of our children, and not just in the campaign contributions they get from the fossil fuel lobby. I mean, there is a sea change going on, and politicians are very slow to catch up on it.
Paul Brown is joint editor at the Climate News Network and a columnist for The Guardian. Tom D'Alessio is president of Next City, both joining us from Paris. Tom and Paul, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss media coverage of Islamophobic and xenophobic rhetoric coming from Republican presidential candidates and right-wing news organizations. Donald Trump's comments about banning Muslims from entering the U.S. has been framed as unprecedented by politicians, media pundits, and commentators. How are the media framing the underlying reasons for the current political climate in the U.S.? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.